Listening to CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
From coast to coast to coast, you're listening to Terra Informa. This is Andrea Miller, and you're listening to an archive originally aired on April 23rd, 2018. Let's listen in to this episode, hosted by Ashley Coaches.
Welcome back to Terra Informa. I'm Ashley Coaches, and I'll be your host for the next half hour of environmental news from across Canada and around the world. This week, it's finally starting to feel like spring. To celebrate the arrival of gardening season, we're bringing you a story about growing food in the most unlikely of places, the city of Yellowknife in the Northwest Territories. The story touches on the determination and creativity required to farm in the north, and what makes it all worth it. Keeping on the topic of food, we also dive into the topic of regenerative agriculture. But first, here are some environmental headlines. On April 3rd, 2018, the Alberta government proposed amendments to the Emergency Management Act as a response to the increase in natural disasters in the province. These natural disasters include the 2011 Slave Lake wildfires, the 2013 Southern Alberta floods, and the 2016 Wood Buffalo wildfires. The amendments create the ability for a new local authority emergency regulation. This regulation provides municipalities with direction on management practices. Some examples are training requirements for cities, local emergency management plans, and the required use of incident command systems. Under the proposed changes to the Act, first responders are not liable for individuals who refuse to follow evacuation orders, and anyone who refuses evacuation orders could be fined $10,000. The rules will become more clear about how compensation will be handled when property is damaged from an emergency response and not the actual emergency. The government will start taking feedback on the amendments from the first responders, local elected officials, and the municipal directors of emergency management, Métis Settlement, and First Nations communities in June. The goal of this legislation is to make sure that cities and emergency managers are better able to respond in disaster situations and that the province and municipalities are coordinated in the mitigation of emergencies and the response. Terra Informer Carter Gorzitsa had the opportunity to speak with France Benoit, who has lived in the city of Yellowknife in the Northwest Territories for 30 years. France was previously a policy worker with the government of the Northwest Territories and now works as a farmer. Carter spoke with her to find out how she found herself in Yellowknife and about the challenges and rewards of growing food in a northern climate.
There are some challenges. You know, we don't have a lot of soil, for example. We have a lot of sunshine, which is nice, but it does create some issues because we have so much sunshine in the summer. But I think the most important thing is to believe that it is possible. It's to believe that you can grow food up north and not to let the challenges drag you down. My name is France Benoit. I came up north to Yellowknife almost, 30 years ago, I would say. And I was originally a policy advisor with the government of the Northwest Territories. And then I became a filmmaker, and now I am a farmer.
So what initially brought you up to Yellowknife? Like, did you do policy in the Northwest Territories before that or after?
No, what brought me to the Northwest Territories originally was a student exchange in Fort Smith, and really liked it, decided to come back to work in the summer in Hay River as a barge cleaner, and eventually made my way to Yellowknife, and I studied the North at university, and so my presence up north was not surprising, and I decided to of course, to do what most people say they do is I stayed for 2 years. I'm going to stay for 2 years, but it's been almost 30 years now. and started my first job with the Department of Education, and I left that in 2000.
So you said you studied the North. What, like, initially interested you in Northern Canada?
Coming on a student exchange from my Cégep in Montreal to come to Fort Smith really opened my eyes to the North, and decided to come back in the summer to help pay for my studies, and worked in Hay River then for two summers. And still, the North was not out of my system, if I can put it that way, and decided to do a master's in polar studies, so did that, and still coming up north was not out of my system. If anything, it was even more. I lived in Greenland for a year and eventually settled here in Yellowknife in 1989.
Was there a lot of people like gardening and farming, I guess, in Yellowknife when you started?
No, and I had, before I moved to Yellowknife, absolutely no gardening experience, and this is why I feel that my own personal experience is one that brings hope, because it really all took place in the Northwest Territories. In fact, my family owned a little grocery store, and for me, which was attached to our house, so for me, food came from that store. And there was no gardening in my family at all. It is only when I moved to Yellowknife, and after a couple of years, I bought the house that I'm still currently living in, which is 25 kilometers outside the city limits of Yellowknife. I live off-grid, and it came with a little garden. And so I was curious and planted a few things, and, you know, some friends gave me a hand. And but I quickly realized that people were giving me very different advice. And I think what happens, it was not really at that time in Yellowknife a gardening culture, if I can put it this way. A lot of the northern knowledge had left, had not been passed on from generation to generation. So people came to Yellowknife with their own gardening experience. And so they brought knowledge from their region of the country, from where they came from. So I had people tell me, you cannot grow tomatoes in gardens. It needs to be in the greenhouse. And then I would have a totally different opinion from somebody else and say, of course you can grow tomatoes in gardens and you don't need a greenhouse. And so I quickly realized that I just needed to develop my own experience and my own knowledge, and it just took off after that. Once I realized I have my own microclimate here, because I live very close to a lake, it's in a bit of a valley, and so I thought, okay, I'm just gonna learn from trial and error.
What would you identify as some of the major barriers that you faced, specifically talking about, like, working with the land where you are on your property?
So for me, it's sort of a paradigm shift that first had to take place is, no, it is possible to grow food, and I will do it. It may not be as easy as having, you know, prairie land that is beautifully fertile, but it is possible. So for me, it's the main thing. It's to unlock that blockage that we have that says it's too far up north, we don't really have soil, and I've proven that, and this is why I like to have open houses at my house, because I am so not typical of a little farm. I'm literally on sheer bedrock. I am on uneven ground. I've got cliffs on the property. I have a lot of rocks on the property. And so what I do is gather those rocks and create rock gardens. Anything that is flat, I try to grow food on, build raised beds on uneven ground. So, like, one side can be 6 inches and the other side is 4 feet. And I make do with that, have some greenhouses, which, you know, have been built over the years, and little greenhouses because I don't have a lot of land. But it is possible. Do a lot of container gardening as well. Build a deck to give myself a flat surface onto which we have planters. So I have decks which are, in fact, giant planters. So it is possible. It's just to see the potential and just to go for it.
Yeah, it's absolutely amazing seeing your farm. Driving up to it, I was like, I think I was with Emma, and I was like, are you sure we're in the right place? Like, I'm like, I just don't...
Are you sure there's a farm here?
Yeah, I'm like, this is a really small road, and there's rocks everywhere. And then, yeah, pulling in, it's amazing how much use you've made of the space.
Yeah.
So I remember you talking to me that you said you were working on making your own soil, which is one of the big problems that people face in your life. So could you slightly, like, run down the process of making your own soil?
Yeah. One of the challenges that we face in Yellowknife, unlike south of Great Slave Lake, where they have beautiful soil, here in Yellowknife, we're on sort of the Canadian Shield, lots of rocks, sheer bedrock, and so on. So one of the challenges is to get soil. And in my case, because for a number of issues, there's contamination in some of the soil in Yellowknife due to the side effects of gold mining in the area. And also at my house, I have a bridge that to get to my house, you have to cross this little bridge. So I cannot have truckloads of soil delivered to my house. So instead of just saying, well, then it's not possible, I just looked into it and decided that I would make my own soil. So there's a method called lasagna gardening, and it's not very difficult. It just takes time. You need to plan sort of one season ahead of time, and you accumulate a lot of organic material. And so I do that constantly. When people come to my house, I tell them to bring their grass clippings and bags of leaves, and I get cardboard, which I lay down on the ground. If I identify an area that I would like to expand into, first you need to sort of cut the brush, a little bit, and you may have to cut a few trees, and I use the wood in my wood stove. So start by laying down the cardboard, make sure that it is very wet, and then I make rows or whatever shape that I want to use. And then you just layer upon layer of organic material. And with each layer, you have to wet it down, to hose it down with water very, very well. So in terms of organic materials, I will have a layer of grass clippings. I'll have a layer of leaves. I'll have a layer of shredded paper. So I shred all of the paper that comes in my house. I get bags of shredded paper from different offices in town. I will put kitchen scraps. I will put more grass clippings and leaves and shredded paper. If I have bags of soil, which I buy at stores in town, or some peat, anything that is organic that I can get my hands on, and build that up, like at least a good 3 feet high, and then cover that up. So I would do like a whole area, like 3-4 rows at least, so that it's really worth it. And then cover that with black tarp. And I use tarps, for example, when the lumber comes to the lumber yard. They cover the wood with these tarps that are black under. And so I gather some of those, and I put that on top of those rows and let it be. So I would do that probably, by the time you have time on the farm, sort of, July, August, when everything has been planted, and essentially what you're doing is maintaining the garden. So there's a little bit more time then. So this is when I lay down the garden, those rows of organic materials for the following summer. And so the following spring, as soon as the snow has melted, you give it a good couple of weeks, the sun shining on the black tarp, it just really helps as well to keep the soil, you know, all of that organic material to decompose. And by the time I remove the tarp, when I'm ready to plant, it's just beautiful composted soil, soil that I made. And we'll probably top it off a little bit with some bags of soil, which I buy at a store in town, and top that off, and then you're ready for planting.
That's awesome. That's definitely an example of resilience.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So you kind of talked about it a little bit just then, but you were talking about the contaminants in Yellowknife. And just for, I guess, like listeners who haven't heard, haven't watched Guardians of Eternity or heard about the arsenic poisoning in Yellowknife, could you just kind of like run down quickly what that is and then kind of maybe how you adapt to that in your own farming practices?
Mm-hmm. Yellowknife has a history of gold mining, and unfortunately, as the process of roasting the ore released the arsenic in the air. The arsenic was present in the ground, in the rocks, and by roasting the rocks to get the gold, the arsenic was released in the air. And in the first few years of operation of Giant Mine, there were, you know, thousands and thousands of kilograms of this arsenic trioxide, which, you know, essentially fell onto the ground. So there's, and depending on wind direction and so on, there's some highly contaminated areas around Yellowknife. The Yellowknife Dene First Nation has a rule, have decided that there's no, you know, berry picking, for example, that takes place around their village, you know, in Dilo and Deda. And so they go more onto the islands, for example, on Great Slave Lake. So their traditional territory not being used anymore for the traditional berry picking and so on. So the area was known as being a really beautiful spot for blueberry picking. They used to say that it was blue as far as the eye could see. Nowadays, you just do not see blueberry bushes close to town. So that is the unfortunate consequence of gold mining, a giant mine in Yellowknife, which has, contaminated some of the soil. There are some hot spots in town, which have been monitored over the years. But that is certainly a challenge. I wouldn't say it creates, it doesn't mean that there's no gardening and farming that can take place in Yellowknife. It just means that we have a few more challenges. And in fact, I think that to take contaminated soil and to somehow turn it in, you know, it's part of healing the land, if I can put it this way, by putting a greenhouse on it, for example, and to grow things upside down, all of a sudden gives you a use of that soil and to, you know, to make it better in a way. I am fortunate in the sense that I'm 25 kilometers away from the mine, and so I do not have myself contamination at my house.
I know it's probably hard to put into words, but what holds you to the north with, like, farming and stuff, obviously, with it being more difficult in the north and all these things? Like, what's keeping you there?
The land is keeping me here. The land has been plentiful. I've been fortunate in being successful in the gardening that I've done in Yellowknife. And I think that if I was not meant to be here, the land would have spoken. The land would not be as plentiful for me. So I am drawn to the north. I think there's a world of possibilities here. And this is where I want to farm. This has become my home. And I feel that the highest authority is the land. And again, if the land did not want me here, it would have spoken. So I feel that this is what I meant to be at this time.
So for the farmer's market in Yellowknife, which is where I've seen you many times when I was there this summer, there's this idea that they want more and more produce, just, I believe, to make a more resilient farmer's market that helps with food security. So what does a food secure Yellowknife and Yellowknife area look like to you in the future, I guess?
The city of Yellowknife has just approved in December their 2018 budget, and in it there's funding available to commence the work of developing a local food strategy for Yellowknife. So the Yellowknife Farmers Market and other organizations and a coalition of individuals and organizations interested in food-related issues, be it food security or food businesses, you know, with economic development, will convene and begin the work of developing a local food strategy for Yellowknife. And there's much to be done. There's high levels of food insecurity in Yellowknife, but I think we need to, and we are very fortunate to have incredible fish in Great Slave Lake, and so food for me is a much higher level of vegetable production, of wild harvesting, berry picking, for example, combined with fish and some of the wild animals that we have. You know, the caribou herds are dwindling, unfortunately, but we still have moose and certainly a lot of fish. So, and to try to do import substitution, try to have less import food, and maybe importation of food can be for different meats, for example, or different vegetables that we cannot grow and harvest here. But I think to become, and to me this is all about resiliency, but to reduce the dependence that we have on imported food from elsewhere, you know, I'm thinking of California, for example. I mean, how long can this model of commercial agriculture continue, really, where people harvesting the food are undocumented immigrants, paid very low wages, water being depleted, monoculture based on GMO and pesticide. I think we have an incredible opportunity up north to not get into this cycle of large industrial monoculture and to skip literally the last 50 years and move ahead on small-scale agroecology, non-GMO, organic, no pesticide, therefore reducing greatly the cost of production, and to feed ourselves and not just our bodies, but our soul as well.
That was Carter Gorzitsa interviewing France Benoit, speaking about farming and the food production in the Northwest Territories. Next, we're bringing you an agricultural eco-babble. Terra Informa Hannah Cunningham dives into the world of regenerative agriculture and tells us what it is, how to do it, and why it's important for the future of food.
Automated metering infrastructure.
Natural energies.
Regulate CO2.
PM control strategies.
Natural resource exploitation.
Steady state.
The United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change.
Uranium.
The enhanced oil recovery.
Sustainable energy.
Eco-babble.
Conversations about agriculture are becoming synonymous with conversations about the environment. And that makes sense, considering the amount of natural resources that are required to feed the growing global population. Growing food is a give-and-take relationship between us and the land, with the land doing most of the giving. While water and sunlight are two big components of a plant's diet, minerals and other nutrients from the soil are also important for growing healthy and productive crops. Conventional farming practices do give back to the land in the form of fertilizer application, adding back nutrients essential for plant growth that each season's crop take up out of the soil. However, the widespread use of fertilizers has resulted in the runoff of these products. Nutrients like nitrogen and phosphorus are great for increasing the productivity of food crops, but they're also great at increasing the productivity of undesirable plants. When these nutrient products are washed into a water body, say a lake, noxious algal blooms can occur that can affect the health of aquatic species. So, how do we give back to farmland without risking the potential spillover of chemical products? Enter regenerative agriculture. Regeneration International, a nonprofit focused on spreading awareness about this type of agriculture, states that the key to regenerative agriculture is not just to, quote, do no harm, unquote, but to actually improve the condition of the land. The goal of regenerative agriculture is to promote the adoption of land use practices that can help regenerate soil fertility and structure, which can then result in the greater ability of the land to store water, sequester carbon from the atmosphere, and promote the biodiversity of plant microorganisms. Methods often used by regenerative farmers include composting, crop rotation, and the integration of animal pasture with cropland. All of these practices encourage the addition and cycling of nutrients in the soil without the use of synthetic fertilizers, relying instead on organic nutrients from manure or the nitrogen-fixing abilities of some crops to add back the essential nutrients that plants take up out of the soil. Activities like composting and the integration of livestock and their manure into food-producing land also allow for the addition of organic matter, which helps to bind the soil together into clumps and helps with water retention, which all helps prevent erosion. These practices can be used to encourage the reaccumulation of rich topsoil in areas where the soil has been stripped of nutrients or has eroded away, allowing food to be grown in areas that previously couldn't support cultivation. All in all, regenerative agriculture strives to leave the land better than we found it, in a way that doesn't interrupt ecological processes that are natural for that specific area. This type of agriculture is currently more labor-intensive and less precise than conventional agricultural practices. However, it's good to be aware of the importance of soil health in food production, and how organic practices can be used to improve the condition of the earth in a more natural way. The Institute for Sustainable Development out of California State University defines regenerative agriculture as, quote, an approach to food and farming systems that works with nature's rhythms and technology, end quote. While we humans often like to think that we're the savviest of the bunch, nature's been in the business of producing food for quite a while. It might just have a few nutrient-rich tricks up its sleeve, and maybe we should be taking some notes.
Uranium,
the enhanced oil recovery.
Sustainable energy.
Eco-babble.
And that was Terra Informa Hannah Cunningham. If you want to hear even more stories like that, check out our website at terrainforma.ca. And while you're there, look for the survey tab in the menu. We would love to get to know our listeners and what you enjoy about the show. Your input can influence the content we gather over the next year. Also, upon completing the survey, you can enter a draw for a chance to win the opportunity to host Terra Informa, like we are right now, with us in Edmonton. If you're from another city, thanks to modern technology, you can still co-host from afar. Speaking of co-hosting, have you ever wanted to be on the radio? Terra Informa is recruiting. If you want to join our team and share your stories, check out the About Us tab on terrainforma.ca. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Terra Informa is a production of CJSR 88.5 FM in Edmonton on Treaty 6 territory. If you have any questions or comments, send us an email to terra@cjsr.com or tweet it at Terra Informa. And don't forget to subscribe on iTunes. Thanks this week to our contributors, Carter Gorzitsa, Amanda Rooney, Hannah Cunningham, Sydney Kravonik, and Charlotte Thompson. I've been your host, Ashley Coaches. Catch you next week.
This was a rebroadcast from April 2018, which we have been airing while we put together some new episodes. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and stay tuned right here to Terra Informa.
This is Bird Note. What a comfort it would be to legions of birders if every bird song were as easy to recognize and remember as that of the olive-sided flycatcher. Take a walk in the mountains of the north or west in summer, and you're likely to hear the olive-sided flycatcher's blithely whistled three-note song. Bird ID guides have tried to capture its pattern and quality with such catchphrases as quick three beers or what peeves you. The bird's behavior also makes it easy to get to know. It perches conspicuously, bolt upright, high in the tops of dead trees. than it sallies out to snatch flying insects. The olive-sided flycatcher is gray with a peaked crown and dark vest.